Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 331.
This week on the podcast, if Louisiana votes on Saturday, couldn't we just all do that?
Plus, impeachment hearings are the birthday gift that keep on giving and taking.
Plus, Roger Stone proves that getting a Nixon tattoo on your back will eventually land you in jail.
And if you're looking for a book deal, there's still time to announce that you're running for president.
And Pete Buttigieg, he's loved by Midwestern white people and fake black people everywhere.
Elizabeth Warren overplans on healthcare and, in the process, accidentally underplans.
And fringe political celebrities are desperate to represent Simi Valley. We've got the update.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
Yeah.
Happy Louisiana Election Day, results day for you. I guess it's going to be Monday when you hear this, but Louisiana is the last general election state of the month.
Yeah.
And that is because they hold their election on a Saturday. They also, they have a weird election system where they do runoffs
right,
for their
they
general.
Had a runoff. So
the primary is very important there.
Yeah, they had... If you don't get, you can avoid a runoff if you get more than 50%.
Right. So there's a chance that like in October or whenever they have the primary.
And so John Bel Edwards was actually close, the Democrat. Yeah. I think he got like 45 or 46% in the runoff. And that's because there were multiple Republicans running.
Right.
But he didn't get 50%. So then they have the actual election, which they had yesterday, which was against Bel Edwards and the Republican.
Rispone.
Yeah.
This is for the gubernatorial race,
yes.
By the way. And they have sort of a similar, they have almost a jungle primary system.
Well, yeah, I mean, it ultimately, that's
but
pretty
the
much
difference
what it is.
That, the main difference is that they don't vote on any normal election days in that state.
Right.
That state is just like a random collection of times that you could vote at random times in your life. And you can vote on election day early there because they have early voting.
Nice.
And they also have a catchy go vote. Hashtag because they have they have go spelled G-E-A-U-X.
I mean, come on.
Because they
That's
have,
it.
You know, they have a fun thing going on there.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy that they are the one state that has this sort of progressive Saturday voting thing
right?
going on. I mean, what a world.
Right. If Louisiana can be getting up to that, then.
We can definitely pull it off here.
Come on, guys.
I mean, there's no excuse if a Voting Rights Act state. Is pulling it off.
Right.
But so it was a close race. Bel Edwards won with 51.3% of the vote. Rispone ended up coming in at 48.7%. It was also a complicated race because it was very hard to track because it was not really leading. Because it was happening on Saturday night, it wasn't like MSNBC was doing wall-to-wall coverage or anything.
Right, I know.
So my mother called me and was like, it's all over. And I was like, how much of the vote is in? And she was like, oh, 1%. And it was because she could only find the results on the New York Times. They are notoriously slow for updating their results. If you
Why
are looking for minute-by-minute election results, as
that's
we often are,
place, that's which do is not disappointing.
Do not check the New York Times results.
Yeah.
Go to any of the news networks that are likely to make a call that's even irresponsible, because they will have updated results that are delivered too fast to even be real. The Times, I guess probably because they're trying to like verify that the results are accurate, which is like, who cares about that? They're often like the last people to find out who's won an election.
So true.
So in any case, this is a state that, I mean, Louisiana is a state that Trump won in 2016 by over 20 points. So like Kentucky, he got a huge margin there.
Right.
And like Kentucky, they have kind of this weird situation going on where statewide offices in a state that is really considered like a pretty deep red state are going to moderate Democrats.
And this was an interesting one because in a similar way to Kentucky, where Matt Bevin, the incumbent Republican there, was sort of widely hated by everyone in the state, the sort of reverse was happening here, and that Bel Edwards, who's the Democrat, is pretty well liked.
Right, he's the current governor.
He's the current governor. He's the incumbent. And he, yes, Trump did win there by over 20 points. But I mean, Bel Edwards is very conservative.
Right.
I mean, he's a conservative Democrat. So
some of us
like,
who are real Democrats might call him a Republican.
Some might.
But
yes.
We're excited that even with the Democratic moniker, he was able to win office in
Yeah,
Louisiana.
Well, and I think that's the big point, because I think what the takeaway here is it's not so much that we're thrilled that John Bel Edwards is the governor of Louisiana. It's that I think that there are a lot of signs that shit's bad for Trump right now and the GOP, because between this and Kentucky, they really tried hard. And nobody, I don't think anybody is delusional about whether the Democratic candidate in 2020 is going to win either of those two states, because I don't really think anybody actually thinks that.
No.
But
this is about margins. It's about down ballot races.
It's about margins. It's about down ballot races. And it's also about what kind of political capital Trump has right now.
Exactly.
And it looks like not very much. So, are we going to win Louisiana? Probably not. But, you know, if Trump doesn't have any political capital, how much is he going to be able to sort of help whatever's going on in Arizona?
Yeah.
Or in Colorado? Or in Iowa? Or in Wisconsin?
Well, and certainly Virginia is a lost cause for him at
right.
this point.
So,
I mean, there are some places where he might have relied on political capital to at least make them competitive that it doesn't look like are going to be competitive at all.
Right. And he doesn't seem to have that right now.
Yeah.
So, of course, things are going to be different when it's actually him that is on the ballot. But,
oh, of course.
Like, it doesn't appear as though he's really sort of able to sway anyone.
Well, and in both
point.
Of these gubernatorial races in Kentucky and Louisiana, they were really wrapping themselves in national political identities in a way that you don't need to as governor. Does the governor have anything to do with impeachment?
No, I know.
But both of them ran on anti-impeachment platforms as
if
for sure. they had any... That's like me and Brent running a block association on an anti-impeachment platform.
Like,
it has nothing to do with anything.
Right, and Trump went down there, had a last-minute rally, was like telling people at the rally to send this, to use this election as a message to national Democrats who are crazy. And and it's just sort of like, but what?
Yeah.
Like, what does that have to do with anything?
It's really like, you know, it's really, I think, indicative of, and, you know, we saw this right after the Trump thing. And this is why I think a lot of people who are like, oh, Trump's going to win again, aren't relying on the weird swings in, weird places that we saw the moment that everyone realized he was actually going to be the president, which is for a long time, we've been seeing really conservative states and districts swinging by 10 to 20 points in ways that make it clear that the margins are not going to be that simple in places where they only had a couple of points to swing.
Right.
I think this is just another example of a state. I mean, this is a state that we really think of as like a conservative stronghold. The Democrat that they ran is like anti-choice. I mean, it's like a crazy state.
Yeah.
And if this is not a state that can comfortably live in their identity as Republicans right now, as people that, you know, are sort of famously kind of conservative and also, you know, comfortable with maybe kinds of policy that are openly racist and other things.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if a state that is sort of for years been comfortable with that kind of an identity is not able to be comfortable with their identity as Republicans, then we kind of have a problem. I mean, we don't. No problem. But I mean, Trump kind of has a problem.
Yeah.
And so this is, listen, it's at least awkward for Trump.
It is.
And it also shows, you know, for a long time, his presence was helpful to candidates in these situations.
Well, and that's the thing. Like,
it is not right now.
And that's what I think is sort of makes me feel good about both of these. Because, you know, he had last-minute rallies in both of these places. People questioned whether people within the GOP questioned whether that was smart, whether he should be sort of, like, wasting the time on these races that, like, don't really have anything to do with sort of, like, how he's going to, like, they can't help him govern, really, regardless of how they end up. And also, like, the only thing that could happen is, like, say you flip it, what do you gain? Nothing.
Right.
But if you don't flip it, which you haven't now in two out of these three states, it's embarrassing. And, you know, the RNC spent like a couple $1 million in this race late. The Republican Governors Association spent a lot of money and time in this late. Mike Pence was down there as well. So it's like they really, the message that got sent was to Trump, not to the...
No, it had nothing to do with state politics.
Not to the Washington Democrats.
No.
You know.
No, the Washington Democrats can walk away feeling great that they both had nothing to do with these races and also lost nothing and gained something in the process.
Right,
I mean,
exactly.
This worked out swimmingly for them.
It did. Yeah.
And these are states... The real issue, these are states that are shocking to hear. Like, every time... I remember when Kentucky first elected their sort of... their last Democratic governor. I remember every time I heard that they had a Democratic governor, I was re-shocked about it.
I know.
And Kentucky isn't even as conservative as states like Louisiana. You know?
No, it's true. Yeah.
And so... I know that there is sort of like a history of conservative Democrats in Louisiana, and certainly, longer-term Dixie Democrats or whatever. But this is kind of a weird moment for a state like – or not a weird moment, but an interesting moment for a state like Louisiana to sort of be shifting back to almost like a Dixie Democrat identity where they're kind of like, well, we'll flirt with being Democrats.
Right.
We're conservative, so we're not accepting any real Democrats.
Right.
But we'll flirt with the identity because being a Republican right now seems lame. You know?
Yes. Like, basically. Yeah, right. Yes.
That,
yeah,
I mean, that's sure. It's yeah. It's too lame to be a Republican right now.
Yeah, it is.
You seem like a lunatic. You seem like a not smart person, you know? Like, they're not trying to seem, they're trying to seem like, you know, like people who can govern themselves at the very yeah. least, you know,
right.
In any case, the big news of the week though was not this, because this happened on Saturday. It was that we started public impeachment hearings, and
it's
you guys,
begun.
We will forever be able to remember the day that the Trump impeachment process started, because it happened on my birthday.
Yeah.
So if you, what a present. The moment that I woke up, I got a bunch of texts saying happy birthday mm-hmm. and then follow-ups asking if I was watching the hearings.
Dreams.
Now, the only downside of living in California is the hearings are happening at, like,
oh my lord,
an hour that's unacceptable.
Right? They should have thought about that.
I mean, if you want to create must-see TV, which
yeah,
you do.
People have to be awake for it.
People have to be awake. And people in states that hate Trump specifically have to be awake, including the fifth largest economy and
the
biggest
Coast.
State in
right. yeah.
the union. So I feel like I would adjust the schedule if I were them. But
sure.
What do I know? I'm just yeah. a person in California. But in any case, so I woke up to the testimony of Bill Taylor and George Kent. Those are two State Department officials that were the first two people to testify
right,
publicly.
On Wednesday.
They had both testified privately before. And so we really thought going in that we weren't going to learn anything new in this
yeah.
testimony. And that was wrong.
Yes.
Before we get into that, though, just a side note. If you, like me, were wondering what Jim Jordan was doing in these hearings, and maybe you're not sort of like that interested in who's on what committee, and so you don't care. But I just want to point out that Jim Jordan is not on the Intelligence Committee. He was temporarily added so that he could just be a theatrical asshole during these hearings.
Yeah, well,
so
that's
working.
His brand.
You know,
yeah,
that's
sure.
his brand.
Yeah.
But I turned on the hearings and I was like, something is so weird about what's going on here. Because what committee is this even? Because why is Jim Jordan here?
Yeah.
And the answer was he shouldn't have. They just added him at the last minute for theater. For literally, that's what he's there doing there. So maybe you didn't notice because you don't care about who's on the Intelligence Committee, and that's fair.
Yeah.
You know, I get it. I don't care that much. But I was just sort of like, what's happening? What is this committee that we're – who's in this inquiry? Why are we doing this?
Yeah.
And that was the answer. The Democrats used a new format for these hearings, and as opposed to the format that they'd used for, you know, like when Mueller testified or when Corey Lewandowski
sure.
testified.
Well, this was all sort of like how they agreed to it when they
right.
they didn't really agree to it because no Republicans agreed to it. But this was how
this was
how it was written when they sort of like passed what the rules were going
exactly.
to be.
Exactly. The rules
right.
were new. Yeah. And basically, so the way that they worked it out is that Schiff and Devin Nunes both get to make their opening statements. The witnesses make their opening statements. But then instead of going straight to questioning from committee members, they allot 45 minutes for each party to ask an extended series of questions. And those questions are mostly being asked by their counsel.
Right.
So Schiff asked a few, but Daniel Goldman, who's one of his staffers, asked most of them for the Democrats. And then Devin Nunes asked a few, but Steve Castor, who's the counsel for the Republicans, asked most of them for the Republicans. And the reason they did this is so that they could get into more detailed exchanges and not just have it be like all theatrics.
Yeah.
Because everyone sort of acknowledges that the member questions are stupid. Half of
oh,
them
for sure.
are long soliloquies about how great the person is,
oh,
and then
say,
an
oh,
insult.
Yeah, a
and
lot of them are
the
not
other half
even,
are like, how is this affecting your family?
Right?
You know, like, they're not, sure. like, real questions. So
yeah.
So there was a lot more substance in these hearings, but they were boring.
Sure.
So there's an upside and a downside to this new strategy, because the thing that the member questioning allows you to do is get into the theatrics right,
right.
away.
So you just ask bombastic things.
And people can
just
scream. People can shout
right.
points of order. I mean, like, you get
yeah.
some real theater
yeah.
out of that. These Democrats are not theatrical Democrats. I
no.
have a contention to make before we get into the content, because that's maybe the important part, but whatever. That if knowing...
I don't think it is.
I was going to say, knowing that Jim Jordan was going to be added as a theatrical component for the Republicans,
yeah.
I feel like the Democrats should have thought, okay, who can we add for theater? Like, we want someone to be there for content. We want some serious discussion. They have enough
yeah.
serious people. There's enough serious people. Too many serious people on this committee.
Right.
Who can we add that is going to be there for straight theater?
Yeah.
And I would contend, and this is not maybe who they would have chosen because this is a contentious choice, but there is one person who has shown them a roadmap for how to do this kind of theater,
yeah.
and it is AOC. Because
for sure.
she can go into a committee and she asks a series of seemingly simplistic questions and leads you down a rabbit hole where your mind gets blown.
Yep.
By the and not
it's true.
Blown,
she's done it multiple times.
Multiple times. And not blown by the kinds of facts where you're like, whoa, I never understood, whatever. Blown by watching people admit to things that are so on the nose stupid
yeah.
in a congressional committee. Like
yeah.
she gets them to say the truth of what's going on. in simple terms that we can all understand.
Yeah.
And that is what they needed someone to do here, because it was a lot of hours of people making a lot of comments that were sort of technical points of responsibility and the State Department procedure and all this stuff. And they really needed someone to break it down for the audience so that the news later could play that clip. And that's kind of what they're lacking. That's my advice to them. However, regardless of that, we learned some new and shocking things pretty early in both hearings.
Yeah.
Because the second hearing happened on Friday, and that was, it had its own bombshell. But we'll start with the Kent and Taylor hearing. Basically, Taylor is a top diplomat in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And so, and he's already been deposed. He's already testified privately. But he disclosed on the stand in public this week that one of his staff members had recently informed him that there was actually an additional phone call after the July 25th phone call on July 26th, where Donald Trump and Gordon Sondland basically made clear that the that Trump intended for, you know, Sondland to interfere and have Ukraine investigate Biden specifically for his political gain. So basically, we found out that there's more to learn about the Ukraine situation than we currently know.
Right.
And that there were additional calls that confirm that what, you know, we see in all of these transcripts and all of these accounts is true. So and that staffer, by the end of that day, they already had announced when he was going to be deposed and he's going to be testifying publicly in the coming weeks. So they found the staffer right away. But basically the staffer says that he was at dinner with Sondland and he heard, and Sondland took a call with Trump and he heard Trump ask about the quote investigations and heard Sondland reply that the Ukrainians were ready to move forward with them. And then afterwards, Sondland said that Trump's interest in Ukraine was primarily about these investigations of Biden that Giuliani has been pushing.
Yeah.
And so Sondland, like, admitted this whole thing to him.
Yeah.
And also, the story kind of suggests that the pressure was coming from Trump personally to investigate the Biden.
And that's really the shocking
twist
because I think that there has been sort of, like, it seems as though one of the things that they were maybe going to attempt to do at some point anyway was to just sort of at least sort of probably find a fall guy for this who wasn't Trump.
Yeah, of course. I mean, what else could they do?
That's what you do.
Yeah.
And this moves it directly to him. Yeah. It also moves it directly to him having a, they were having this conversation in a restaurant.
Like, and also, all the way on.
It wasn't on, it's like, not as if Sondland put him on speakerphone either.
No, this is, it's mind-blowing in its stupidity beyond being mind-blowing in its initial stupidity. Like, there are layers of stupidity to it that are mind-blowing, which is, I think, why everyone was like, there was another call and it was this stupid.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the thing, you know, we've been saying this a long time about how a lot of stuff with Trump you can assume is happening in an obvious and ridiculous manner. Like, you don't have to, there's not a strategy going on. So you just think, what would a stupid person do to make something like a stupid scheme happen?
Yeah.
And that's usually what's happened. And that's, you know, you can usually assume how everything happened. This is exactly what I would have guessed would happen. But I think everyone would have been like, no, obviously there was more going on. Obviously, Trump wouldn't just call the EU ambassador, who's for no good reason involved in this issue in the first place, to push an investigation that Giuliani, a private citizen, is trying to make happen on a diplomatic level for reasons no one can quite identify.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, he wouldn't just make the call. But
that's exactly what he would do.
Obviously what he would do. Where else would it have come from?
Yeah.
There is not a mastermind scheming dumb ideas behind him. There are people who are enacting his dumb ideas. There are people who are helping him come up with dumb ideas.
Right.
But the dumb ideas are really often coming straight from him. It's not, there's not like, there's not, Steve Bannon's gone, you guys.
That's right.
You know, and Stephen Miller, who got in a little hot water this week also for being a white nationalist.
Surprise.
You know, there's apparently a big pressure. There's a lot of pressure inside the White House to fire him because.
Right. Well, and pressure from outside the White House
For him to resign. But apparently there's also like a White House, like White House staffers are now pressuring them to. So that's not great. But in any case, it's not, there's not the boogeyman behind Trump. The dumb ideas are coming straight from him. Straight out of his mouth. So of course he made this phone call. In any case, the GOP didn't have a great defense for any of this because how could you?
No.
So they mostly went after the Bidens as if somehow proving that the Bidens are unsavory people makes Trump unimpeachable. And that's crazy. Listen, I have said a long time, this whole time, put the Bidens on the stand. I don't fucking care about the Bidens.
Oh, yeah.
The I couldn't care less about the Bidens. If you want to take the Bidens down with Trump, I don't fucking care. The idea that the Bidens are guilty of something doesn't mean that Trump is not guilty of something.
Though. I know.
Like, that's, I think they're trying to argue that somehow the Bidens are the shady ones and Trump is just in there trying to get to the truth.
Well, and I think it's hilarious, too, because I think that, like, some people are just sort of like, oh, you know, Hunter Biden was, like, profiting like on something like in Ukraine while his dad was the vice president or something.
Right. It's like
as if to like
as if he's not able to have a job.
Right. And well, and also
the entire aristocracy is doing this.
That's what I was going to say. The entire Trump family is currently working inside the White House right now.
Yeah, exactly. Like
that's, daughter, son-in-law. I mean, anyone. So.
The whole idea that they are somehow accusing the Bidens of something that, A, they're not doing themselves, but also is not something that is a problematic but certainly ubiquitous part of Washington culture is insane. But also, like I said, I don't fucking care if Hunter Biden is an asshole. I don't care if under the Obama administration, shady shit was happening in Ukraine.
Yeah.
I don't know that I believe it was, but I don't care if it was. That doesn't mean that Donald Trump can, for personal reasons, while he's trying to run a campaign against Joe Biden, decide that he needs dirt on all of this for reasons that have nothing to do with national security and, in fact, infringe on our national security and on Ukraine's national security because they're tied to important military aid.
Yeah.
Like, these are two unrelated things. Yeah. The Bidens being good or bad people has no bearing on whether Donald Trump is guilty of something here.
Yeah.
And that's, the GOP is trying to just sort of confuse that point a little
bit.
Well,
right. Well, and they're trying to confuse everything because, and that's what you,
because what can you do?
That's exactly right. Yeah. I was listening to something on NPR this week and they were talking to sort of like a, you know, pretty well-known defense attorney and was like, this is a classic defense case when you don't have a case.
Yeah.
Like what they are doing right now is like what you do when you have nothing. Like what did you hear from the Republicans this week for them to sort of like dispute any of this information?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Well, here's
they presented no facts dispute any of this
information. Their one attempt to dispute it was basically the argument of if a tree falls, where they were like, you guys only heard secondhand about all of this. And the fact that the White House has released notes that corroborate the story, that the entire whistleblower report's been corroborated by other people, the fact that witnesses have come forward and corroborated all of this, notwithstanding, their argument was basically like, well, you, Kent and Taylor, did not personally hear this phone call, so how do we know it happened?
Right.
And I was like, we know it happened because the White House told us it happened. That's who told us it happened.
Yeah.
We found out about every
Rudy
detail.
Rudy Giuliani told us that it happened.
The White House
on television
released notes for the call that told us what happened on the call. I mean, it came from inside the house. It wasn't like we just decided to invent a story that everyone is now unable to prove. Like, everyone has corroborated the story.
Right.
But that was Jim Jordan's attempt to make an argument that they didn't have a case. And then the rest of it was just Devin Nunes going down like Fox News rabbit holes.
Oh, yeah.
His opening statement was wacky. It mentioned a lot of things, including Adam Schiff being approached about buying nude pictures by a prank caller. I mean, like a lot of stuff went on. He talked about the Steele dossier. I mean, he really went for it.
Yeah.
And none of it made sense. But basically, like this argument that Jim Jordan was trying to build, what was the idea that, well, Trump actually did let the aid through eventually, so obviously we can't prove that it was related to a quid pro quo. I just, so that we all are on the same page, wanted to note that here's the list of things that happened in the days before Trump finally released the military aid.
Okay.
Because I think the idea is that the aid was not linked to the investigations, that he was just holding on that for some other reason.
Right, for some other reason.
But really what happened was that he got public pressure to release the aid and then finally had to do it, even though his intention was to not release it until he got this Biden investigation. But here's what happened in the days before he released the aid. An inspector general wrote to Schiff about the whistleblower complaint. Schiff announced an investigation into Giuliani's influence on Ukraine policy. Taylor, who was testifying, put his concerns in writing finally. And then John Bolton resigned.
Yeah.
Like, there was a reason that he finally relented on that.
Right,
had
because
nothing
he
to
saw
do.
That shit was about to hit the fan.
Exactly. But so, in any case, the Republican case was confusing. It was theatrical.
Sure.
For sure. But it was kind of, they weren't able to make a coherent point.
Right.
And it was also helpful.
Well, they don't have one.
They don't have one. So that's, it was helpful that Taylor and Kent were, for the first witnesses that we've heard in a sort of case or a hearing that is about Trump's behavior, that were like eager to testify.
Yeah.
Like they were there under subpoena. But so far we've heard Mueller, who did not want to have to testify.
Yeah.
We've heard Corey Lewandowski, who was trying to basically subvert his own testimony.
Right.
And those hearings were sort of nonsense. And so they were kind of a bust. Yeah. But these guys came to seem like to be upstanding public servants, and they wanted to tell the story, and so they were willing to, you know, they were eager to answer the questions, they wanted to answer them truthfully, and they wanted to give as much information as they had.
Yeah.
And
well,
that
and,
was already a bad look.
It was. And it shouldn't be surprising to anyone And I'm not saying that they are specifically there to attempt to take Trump down, like, in some sort of, like, giddy way.
No, but also, he's been attacking the State Department.
That's exactly what I was going to say, because the same with Yovanovitch, who testified on Friday, sort of specifically spoke about how he has, how bad of shape the State Department is in.
Right, and how low morale is, how...
Right, and, like, this really, I mean, you know... This is sort of like the revenge of the State Department to a degree.
The deep state's coming for him, and it turned out to be the State Department and not who they thought the deep state was.
Right? I mean, you know, like...
No, I mean, this is also, I think, the State Department is sort of uniquely positioned to do this credibly because they are an impartial department.
Right.
So... And this should also be the case with the FBI and the CIA. Like, this is the case with a lot of agencies, but that's not how Trump has been portraying them. The State Department, because a lot of these people are career people who have worked under everyone, and because they don't have the, you know, Comey sort of tainted the FBI's sort of claim to being impartial.
Sure.
And so there was that, there's that issue. Like, there's issues with the intelligence community because Trump was so eager to take them on so quickly. And also there were people that made mistakes in those departments that made it hard for the rest of them to come forward. In the State Department, you know, the Trump has been repeatedly sort of insulting their work and sort of making it impossible
for them
to do their jobs.
For them to do their job too, because there's been, that's the other thing.
And it's that their job is getting too hard.
Well, right. Well, and that's the other thing that Yovanovitch talked about is just, you know, the lack of communication is sort of like making it, and especially in her case, who was working in Ukraine when she had sort of this shadow, foreign policy going on with Giuliani and various people, it was making it very hard for her to do her job because she really didn't even know whether she was on the same page with the White House most of the time because, like, she was sort of, like, left, you know, flapping in the wind. And she's the freaking ambassador.
Yeah.
It's like...
No, exactly.
And this is...
And an experienced ambassador.
An experienced ambassador.
She's not a fake ambassador like Sondland.
Right, exactly. You know, and you've got to believe maybe in Ukraine more than other places because there was a specific issue about this sort of quid pro quo thing with Hunter Biden. But, like, this is going on all over the world.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, to the extent that, you know, maybe there's not sort of nefarious Rudy Giuliani sort of, like, shadow foreign policy going on. But there might be. But just to the extent... where there is sort of, like, no coherent foreign policy. There's no communication between the Trump White House and, you know, any of their ambassadors. The State Department is in shambles. So all of these people, sort of, like, whether they like Trump or not, are struggling to do their job effectively.
Yeah. Anyone who's worked in Hollywood will find this a familiar state of affairs, where there's literally... just, like, craziness happening at the top. And then there's people who are, like, the foot soldiers of doing the, like, boring work that keeps diplomacy going. And those people get contradictory orders. Are currently, they don't usually, but are currently getting contradictory orders from every place that sort of, like, helps them form their strategy.
Yeah.
So there's, like, no way for them to know really, like, first of all, they're being asked to act in ways that are improper.
Right.
So that's already problematic. But second of all, diplomacy is like a sort of it's a sensitive business. It's and sure. A lot of it relies on trust and communicate and kinds of soft communication and soft power that you have to feel like you actually have in order to do it effectively. So like part of the problem here is if you as the ambassador are being perceived by another government as someone who has no connection to what's going on and no idea what's going on, you lose all your soft power, and your soft power is really what your job is.
Right.
So, like, that's problematic. Yeah. So, on Friday, Marie Yovanovitch testified, and there was a little theater at the beginning of that. But first, I want to have a discussion about how you pronounce Kiev. Or Kiev. I couldn't tell you. Yeah. I feel like we're back in the Qatar Qatar era.
Sure.
Remember when we didn't know how to pronounce those, and we still don't know?
Yeah. I knew it was Kiev.
Why?
Because... let me tell you why.
Were you using that in conversation with anyone, though?
Well, I don't know because I...
never talked about it.
But I know because 2 years ago, the Eurovision Song Contest was in Kyiv. And I watched it, and I remember having the same mind-blowing revelation that everyone else is having now while I was watching that. Because I was like... I think it took me like... well, that thing's like 10 hours to watch. I was probably into hour 6 of that before I was like... where are they actually? Like, where are we? What's happening here?
No, it's so bizarre to find out that a country doesn't pronounce their capital the way that
the rest of Earth does.
Right.
Yeah.
It's such a weird choice on everyone's part. But I also feel like much with the Qatar situation, you now are in it. Like, we're now all in a world where we have to adjust our pronunciation to the audience. Because anyone who's been watching the hearings is aware that it's now Kyiv.
Right.
But if you haven't been watching the hearings, you don't fucking know where Kyiv is. And then you have to be like, if you're explaining to someone what's going on in the hearings, you have to use Kyiv.
Because
that's the only, otherwise they're not going to know where you're talking about. In the same way that if you're talking to someone who's familiar with Middle Eastern politics, you might say Qatar.
Yeah.
If you're talking to random Joe Schmo about what's going on in the Middle East, you're fucking saying Qatar. Because you're trying to make them know where you're talking about. So this has created, and the Times even had an article about it because it's created so much mayhem because everyone in the hearings is using a different pronunciation for Kyiv. And I think it's like Kyiv is a Russian pronunciation and Kyiv is the Ukrainian pronunciation too. So there's like another layer to it where the people that are saying Kyiv are trying to indicate that they are like in with
Ukraine.
Right. But so a lot of Republicans are doing it in part to seem like they're not trying to be nefarious assholes. And then, you know, the State Department people are doing it because they work in the region, so they know how to pronounce the city that they were all living in. But I've noticed that among the sort of congressional questioners and council, it's been chaos.
Yeah.
I mean, pure chaos.
Yeah.
So in any case, Yovanovitch is the former ambassador, and that's because she was fired and then Trump trashed her on a phone call with Zelensky.
Yeah.
That on that July 25th call, in fact, was, I think he said that she was the people she was dealing with were bad news.
I mean,
it's like, come on. The real issue was she wasn't on board with his insano shadow foreign policy, obviously, which was just about advancing his personal campaign agenda.
Yeah.
But so the great political theater at the top of this hearing was, and listen, it would have been better if it was delivered by someone with any charisma. Like, I think we all know that. But Adam Schiff did his best.
Sure.
He basically, the president tweeted about her during the hearing.
Right.
And Schiff read it to her and then had to respond in real time. And the tweet was, "Everywhere Maria Yovanovitch went turned bad. She started off in Somalia. How did that go? Then fast forward to Ukraine, where the new Ukrainian president spoke unfavorably about her in my second phone call with him. It is a U.S. president's absolute right to appoint ambassadors." Now, first they have a discussion about how that's not true, because ambassadors have to be confirmed by the Senate. So it's not, the president doesn't have an absolute right to appoint anyone.
Yeah.
But second of all, it gave her a chance to defend her record. And she gave a really compelling speech about how she actually feels like, you know, even in Somalia, even in places where there were real challenges, she felt like her presence was a positive thing and that her work there had been positive and had sort of helped usher at least some positive reforms into those systems.
And that's the thing, you know, those were, because there was another one too that I think that she had in addition to Somalia, that was the one that he referenced, but they were hardship posts.
Right,
she had a couple hardship posts. And like, often good people at the, you know, people who are good at their job get those posts.
Right, because you need a real person to go to Somalia. Right. You can't have some idiot who donated to your campaign.
And as she sort of noted, which I think anyone with half a brain would know, it was not Marie Yovanovitch's, you know, sole, you know, she didn't cause any, you know, the downfall in Somalia.
Right. She hasn't caused a war in her personally in her time.
She doesn't have that kind of power. And like, that's not what the ambassador does anyway.
It was such a great switch because the Republicans had sort of gone in hoping to essentially back up Trump's claim that she was bad news.
Right.
And because it started off with her making a very clear, not only distinction between what Trump was saying about her and what her record actually shows, but also indicating that she was both proud of the work that she had done and understood what her job had been.
Yeah.
They suddenly had to fall over themselves with all these fucking honorifics and compliments before they made their dumb points.
Yeah.
And that really undercut what they were saying a lot of the time, because instead of being able to sort of paint her as a non-credible source, they kind of had to, they were just sort of painting ideas as a non-credible source.
Yeah.
Like they couldn't, you know, Trump couldn't be non-credible. She couldn't be non-credible. So it was just like, well, the Democrats aren't letting us speak enough. Like, they had to kind of rely on, like, lame things like that.
Well, and when they came back from that first recess, when they went outside and probably saw that the president was getting just raked over the coals for this, including on Fox News, where people were just sort of like, oh, well, he just handed Schiff another article impeachment here for, you know, pressuring a witness.
Well, and they note that in the hearing, you know.
Right. That the Republicans were extra nice to her.
I mean it was
before
wild.
Telling her that she was an idiot, but I mean, like, it was a noted change in tone when they came back, and I think it was because they realized that they couldn't be perceived as, like, continuing to do what the president had just done to her. So, like, he not only was it stupid of him to do because of the fact that he did give Schiff just another article of impeachment, he also really sort of, like, hamstrung his own party, who was trying to, you know, question her in the hearings.
Yeah. No, and it meant that the only real moment of theater that they were able to squeeze out of it was Elise Stefanik, who's a moderate New York Republican, not from the city, but from outside the city, who basically overstepped her time, and Schiff said that her time had expired, and then she kept talking and kept talking and kept talking, and finally he slammed down the gavel and said, "The gentlewoman will be suspended." Mm-hmm. And Fox News, like, ran with it because it was all they had. Yeah. And suddenly Twitter had to run with it because it was the most exciting thing that had happened so far, because someone finally shouted and slammed a gavel down. But basically all they could do was pretend they were being silenced, that they were shocked by the treatment of, you know, of Elise Stefanik. And literally all she was doing was bullshitting.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like that was a strategy meant to encourage bullshitting. And meanwhile, the kinds of claims that were being made about Republicans about the administration's behavior were getting too hard to refute. Because, I mean, as Schiff points out in his opening statement, he mentions Giuliani basically admitting that they have this strategy in Ukraine on television repeatedly.
Right.
And so, like, you know, he not only had this involvement in Ukraine in the first place, but in the Times in May said, "We're not meddling in an election, we're meddling in an investigation, which we have the right to do." On CNN, with that Chris Cuomo interview that Chris Cuomo thought he had solved America with, Giuliani first said that they hadn't asked the Ukrainians to investigate Joe Biden, and then a few moments later said that of course they had done that.
Yeah.
So Giuliani has admitted on television that they were doing exactly what the claim is that they were doing, and that Yovanovitch is claiming that they were doing. And so the GOP was sort of left to make a scattered argument again about Biden, and then also just about sort of like how unfair life is, basically, like that.
Right.
Like, so I think, you know, they have been better at theater moments, which they always are.
Yeah.
But they're not effectively making a coherent point because they don't have one to make. And every time they try to start making one, they get undercut.
Yeah.
By their own people. Oh, yeah. I mean, like, it's wild how ineffective they've been. And the reason that Trump was watching at the beginning, they had basically been sending messages through the media to Devin Nunes to let him know that Trump was watching so that his opening statements would be their talking points. And that was why Trump was watching to tweet. And then Trump pretended like he didn't watch the rest. And then later in the day admitted that he had.
Right, that's right. I forgot about that.
I mean, the whole thing was wild. And then, just as a side note, I just want to remind everyone one more time that the Ukrainian president we're talking about is a former television star famous for playing a president on TV in a comedy.
In a comedy.
So just so we don't lose sight of how, like, cuckoo bananas this whole situation is, because it is like two television stars battling it out in a wildly unprecedented situation. And there are other ways in which this is unprecedented.
Yeah.
Politico had a great article about the many ways in which this impeachment process is fairly unprecedented.
Yeah.
A lot of it has to do with how we consume media now and how that makes it so that we can all kind of watch in real time as this happens and not just watch the testimony unfold, but also people's reactions are happening in real time on Twitter. The commentary is happening in real time. And so, and also because we're watching the hearings live streaming everywhere, new information is being dropped in real time. Because usually, so basically, like, in the Clinton era even, the way that these hearings were conducted, the public basically learned the prosecution's whole case at once when Ken Starr dropped that report.
Right,
it wasn't dripping out in the way that it's dripping out now. And in the Nixon era, they televised the Watergate hearings in the Senate. But there had been a lot going on prior to that point that had not kind of gotten those ratings,
one of the most fascinating things that I learned about that Slow Burn podcast is that they had started
impeaching him for fucking years
before he won 49 out of 50 states. They had already started looking into this, but
the point
nobody
at which
had bothered
we're at
to care.
Now
right
no one was even watching in the Watergate era.
Right.
And it wasn't until after the Saturday Night Massacre that it kind of became like must-see TV.
Right. And so, then it happened fast.
And then it happened really fast. Yeah. But so if it feels like it's happening slowly, it's in part because we're watching the drip, drip, drip part of the information right. live in
where
real time.
Previously we didn't
where
have
that
drip,
would just
drip,
kind of
drip,
get dropped in our
drip,
lap
drip,
one day. Right. And then we would be like, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
So this and then also this is not happening in the Judiciary Committee. So we're one step removed from the part of the process where judiciary
right.
actually goes
well,
over.
Well, and this is the
and
the
so that's unusual.
It, right. Well, it's the first impeachment trial that we've had that has been about
foreign policy. So, yeah, exactly.
Right, yeah.
So and then also, you know, because of the way that the media cycle works now, the sort of various sides in former impeachment trials could not get away with the kind of fake news that they like
yes.
there was no There was not an established tradition of people watching like openly propagandistic news for their
right.
coverage, and because of that, the you know at this point the Republicans are repeating conspiracy theories in their questioning.
Right.
They are going on camera after the testimony and repeating lies. I mean, like actual non-facts
yeah.
are being portrayed as part of the conversation here in a way that would not have been possible before the 24-hour news era.
Right, because, you know, when you think about either of those two, and granted, you know, we did have cable news in the Clinton era, but...
Right, but it was early in the Fox News era.
It was
early even in the CNN era.
Right, and when you think about sort of like when we were sort of like only consuming news sort of like with the nightly news, or even further back than that in the, you know, in the next day's newspaper, those places would have sort of watched the hearings during the day, and then would have had at least a little bit of time before going on live television that night
right.
to fact check everything.
Exactly.
So these, you know, and places are trying to fact check in real, well, some organizations are trying to fact check in real time, others aren't.
Right.
But, you know, it's hard. So when you're airing these, you know, all day, every day, you sort of, if all you are watching are the live portions of it, and then you never, you know, if you all you do is watch Fox News all day, during the day, I mean, people who watch Fox News all day are not getting the facts ever about anything
right.
anyway. But I mean, like,
I mean,
you know, there's never any sort of, there's never any live fact
checking.
When
there's never been a time where the president's base has been watching an alternative news source.
Right.
So, like, even in the Nixon era, the people who were standing behind Nixon, which for
right.
a long
and
time was
had,
everybody.
He had his defenders, for sure, up until the very last moments.
Probably past the very last moments,
right.
if we're using the, you know, given how what percentage of the population was supporting him before
yeah.
that point.
Yeah.
But there was not a way for all Nixon supporters to, like,
right.
tune into their
state
own
propaganda.
TV network
right.
to watch the hearings.
Yeah.
They were all watching the same news and having to, at some point, realize that their conclusion had been wrong about Nixon,
right.
which is not what anyone
yeah,
is doing
nobody
right
who's
now.
Watching Fox News has to ever realize that what they think is wrong.
No, exactly. They're
yeah.
just heading down down a rabbit hole.
Yeah.
But so, like Brent said, this is the first time that an impeachment has turned on a matter of national security, which would, I would think, in a rational time, mean that some of the sort of domestic squibbles that we have and some of the partisan politics that we have would be stripped out of it, because national security is in everyone's interest. And for the most part, this kind of foreign policy is not controversial. You
right.
know, the kind of foreign policy that we pursue in order to, like, support allies, maybe it's
well,
controversial
right.
how much of it's military aid, how much of it's humanitarian aid, whatever.
Right.
We're not... There's the sort of the ambassadors, the embassy in Ukraine's job is not super controversial.
Right. This
on
is
a
not
partisan
a,
level.
This, we're not impeaching him on whether he lied about going to war.
Right.
Or, you know, I mean, it's like.
This is, but it's interesting that given that the Republicans have stuck so sort of aggressively to defending him and essentially acting as his legal defense.
Yeah.
As if they are on trial, as if
yeah.
they are his lawyers.
Yeah.
And that. You know, there's of course partisan politics at play in any impeachment hearing. I mean, the impeachment hearings for Clinton were
Clinton.
Nonsense.
Oh my God. Yeah.
You know, ridiculousness. And that was the most partisan thing up until this point that had really ever happened in our lifetimes. So obviously, I'm not suggesting that everyone just acts like friends in impeachment hearings for
right.
the good of the nation, but there is sort of it feels like there should be a sort of exception in this case, because this is somebody who has compromised national security in an effort to be an asshole
right.
and not on the level of just like lying about who they're sleeping with.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting that the Republicans have sort of stayed as kind of steadfastly
yeah.
Supportive, and to the extent that they're like able to repeat lies on television.
Right.
But also, This is the first time that the president has had a tool that has allowed him to weigh in on the test, on the hearings as they're happening.
Yeah.
Twitter didn't used to be around, you guys.
Yeah.
So this is the first impeachment that we've ever had with Twitter.
Yes.
And I feel like our last impeachments were better for it. Because this is, first of all, I don't know what kind of lunatic-y president, well, I do, would think to try to use Twitter during an impeachment. Like, this right? is a time where now he is, like, actually potentially committing a crime in front of us while people are watching.
Right.
In a way where we're looking for the crime now. We're not just like, oh, isn't he zany? Yeah. Like, we are listening to people testify about a crime he may have committed.
Right.
And in the process, he's witness tampering on Twitter?
Yeah.
I mean, this is fucking nuts.
Yeah.
But so basically this, the fact that this is like a fact-free, you know, free-for-all is kind of unusual.
Yes.
Not that there's been so many impeachments, but I will note that one thing this article said that I thought was kind of nuts is, so we've only had four impeachment, or at least impeachment processes, in history.
Mm-hmm.
And three of those have happened in our parents' lifetime.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
That's kind of nuts, right?
Yeah, it is.
I mean, like,
yeah.
What's happening here?
Yeah.
What is right. What is America right now? Like, this is wild.
Yeah.
But so, in any case, the other thing, and this is something that I think is going to eventually kind of be borne out in courts and other places, but we have never faced a presidency that is, like, refusing to turn over subpoenaed information on the level that this,
right. know,
to turn over records and matters of public record and information
right.
that is being requested by a committee.
Yeah.
Like on this level.
Yeah.
I mean, sure. Nixon didn't openly give us the tapes the first day that
sure.
he was on trial.
Yeah.
But that's not, but even his administration was doing the basic cooperating on the basic levels that you're required to as public officials. And this White House is truly acting like they're above the law.
Right.
So, in any case, it's an exciting and unusual time.
Yeah.
And
what would be really great is if Donald Trump himself wants to show up to the impeachment
hearings. Think of the ratings.
Because he's invited.
He's been invited. He's
officially invited.
That's right. Nancy Pelosi finally,
yeah.
not finally, has all along maintained that this is the case on some level, but has
yeah.
said specifically.
Right. Well, and she's doing it to call his bluff. Because
yeah,
one of the things that he and the Republicans have been saying is that they are not having the opportunity to sort of like properly like tell their story,
yeah.
you know? And it's like, well, come and tell it.
Right. Anytime.
We're here.
Can you imagine how amazing a hearing where Donald Trump is the witness would be?
I can't. And it will never happen.
It will never happen.
In this lifetime or any other. And it's because he's not competent enough to do it.
Well,
and
absolutely.
And everybody knows it.
Oh,
he,
yeah.
Except for him. He might want to go.
Oh, I'm sure he does. I'm sure he
but
thinks.
But he can't.
No. There is literally no way that they can let him sort of unbridled, unhinged.
The Republicans in Congress would not even want him to show up there.
No. Yeah. Nobody wants him.
It would
him.
Just be eviscerated.
It would be so awkward for everyone except for us who would enjoy every moment of television that it would provide. That I can't even imagine a situation in which there's like anyone in the White House context who is like currently competent enough to stand to deliver testimony at this point.
Yeah.
Like anyone who would like be an insider at the White House at this point has left.
Oh yeah.
Like no competent people are trying to be involved. That's why you're seeing all these people like who are medium people. Like Steve Bolton is like a medium real person. He's a crazy person, and he has a dumb mustache. John Bolton. Sorry, what did I say?
Okay. Steve.
Oh, Steve Bolton.
John Steve.
God, yeah. In any case, no, John Bolton is like a real person with like a real pedigree, even though it's like kind of crazy. Like
right.
he's like a person who like exists in Washington circles and is like sort of a known crazy person in Washington
right.
and respected.
But probably
crazy
competent
person.
Enough to sort of like
he could
answer questions in full sentences.
Absolutely. That is why he's left. You know? Like, he's not trying to have to deal with this bullshit
right.
while he inevitably ends up on the stand here.
Yeah.
So in any case, the ratings would be outrageous, and because of that, we really encourage Donald Trump to consider it.
Yeah.
He is the last word in whether he shows up for a hearing.
Yeah.
He does not have to listen to his handlers. If you are Donald Trump right now, think about the must-see TV opportunity
yes.
that is you testifying before
yes.
the Intelligence Committee.
Yes.
I feel like that's an ace in the hole. That's winning. Let's get on Twitter and let him know how much we would watch that.
Yeah.
And then let's let him have a TV show spinoff.
Sure. I don't know what it is,
but I mean, it feels like that's a good, you know, consolation prize for him.
Yeah.
It's something for him to produce from jail.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Maybe it's like a daily talk show from jail with that he hosts with Roger Stone.
Yes.
Because they'll both be there.
They can be there together. Because Roger Stone was found guilty by a federal jury. Yeah.
Maybe not as long as for we would like him.
No, I know. He's really like trying to capitulate, he's trying to sort of indicate to Trump that he's ready for his pardon.
Yes.
But
he was found guilty on all 7 accounts.
That's right. Well, here's the problem with him was that he's guilty on like 1,000 accounts.
Right.
So,
but 5 of them were felony counts.
Yeah.
Lying to investigators, 1 count of obstructing a congressional probe, 1 count of witness tampering.
He's done all the things that you could try.
Yeah.
He's done everything that you would imagine a man with a giant Richard Nixon tattoo on his back would do.
That's right. Yeah.
If you ever meet anyone whose back is a portrait of Richard Nixon tattooed permanently on, then I think it's safe to assume that at some point they will be witness tampering.
Yeah.
You know, that's a safe assumption to make with that guy.
Right. Also, important to remember that this case was brought out of the Mueller investigation.
That's right. We're still dealing with that.
Right. The Mueller investigation, which was just a big waste of money and a giant witch hunt, and nothing ever came of it. Add these 7 counts to the already million counts that have
half of his campaign staff that's in jail now.
Right, exactly. Yes.
I mean, it's
what Paul Manafort can also co-host that with them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, they can all be at Otisville or whatever it is, the white collar jail that everyone goes to.
Yeah.
Where they have like a golf course or tennis courts or whatever it is. And I'm sure there'll be popular guys around the cell block because they're all fucking shysters.
Right.
And that's who goes to fucking jail. Who else is in white collar jail? This is like a chance. Michael Cohen. Yeah.
They probably know everybody there.
I remember
just the people that ran a campaign with.
No, they'll know everyone. They've worked with literally every single person in that facility.
Yeah.
When Michael Cohen first went to jail, there were all those articles about how much more relaxed he was.
Those were his people.
He was amongst his people. Donald Trump was off his back. Like, everything was kind of going swimmingly. It's kind of a nice time for him to kind of, you know, unplug a little.
Yeah.
So in any case, so Trump, I guess, could issue a pardon or, commute a sentence or something.
Yeah.
I'm curious to see what happens with that. Trump is already hitting Twitter to remind us of all the other potential criminals that we could be investigating, like Shifty Schiff, Crooked Hillary, a Comey.
Sure.
The man who gave him the election.
Right. Yes.
Unfortunate, but whatever. Yeah. You know, there's Steele is even on that list. What a weird choice. But, you know, and all the others.
Yeah.
He mentions all the others, too.
Yeah.
It's a long list of
Didn't they lie?
That's right. Didn't everyone? So, in any case. We'll see. We'll see what happens with how long he actually ends up in jail.
Yeah.
But we did learn a lot from this case about Trump's campaign connections to WikiLeaks and other things like that. So it was useful.
All going through,
That was all going. Yeah, that
Stone.
Exactly. That was useful to us as people who would like to know the extent of the crimes that were committed by the Trump campaign at some point in our lives.
Yeah.
So. Now we have, so that's what's going on in impeachment land.
Yes.
In election land.
2020 land.
2020 land, we're having a weird trend right now.
We're about to have like a second primary.
Yeah, we're about
with different people.
Exactly. We're like, it's like there's been like a rebirth of the primary season.
Right.
Because if you thought that 24 people announcing they were running for president was too many.
Yeah.
Which most of us did.
It wasn't
apparently
quite enough.
It wasn't quite enough for Deval Patrick.
Nope.
Mm-mm. You know, we already talked last week about
Bloomberg
trying to jump into the race.
There's some other people who are supposedly, you know, Hillary was out there how she's being begged and pleaded with. Eric Holder supposedly is like dropping hints that like he might start thinking about it again.
No.
All these people are just sort of like, oh, okay, sure, why not? We're still doing it.
If Hillary Clinton runs
of
for president.
Of all of the people
I mean,
that I am hoping will from that list, because nobody cares about Deval Patrick.
No, he wants a book deal. That's fine. We all want a book deal.
Yeah, and nobody is going to vote for Michael Bloomberg, so like whatever. But like Hillary Clinton should definitely run for president again, because that would be good television.
Oh.
And she will have her ass handed to her, at least in this primary.
Yeah.
I mean,
there's too many real people in
there. There's no reason for her to run, and everyone still, you know, maybe has some a little bit more respect for her than they did at some point, but like the hatred still exists.
Oh,
for Hillary Clinton.
For
that
sure.
That didn't go away.
Also, I would love to hear her account of why she, the only person capable of losing to Donald Trump,
right.
should get to try it again.
Right? Yeah.
She's lost to so many nobodies in the course of her attempts to be the president.
Oh, yeah.
I would love to hear her get onto a debate stage and explain to me why she's a safe choice for this year's primary.
Yeah.
So there was some controversy in Warrenland this week because she revealed her Medicare for All rollout plan.
Yes.
And the left was not having it.
Not having it at all. And I get it.
I totally get it.
I get it. Because basically, you know, the one thing, she had released the plan as to how she was going to pay for it. And there were some issues with that, potentially. Not enough that I don't think she was ever going to be held so accountable for it that it was going to become an issue for her, probably.
Yeah.
Because I think the math added up vaguely well enough.
Right. And when also, she's, like, this is like a campaign plan. Like, obviously, as a person who was actually pursuing the policy, they would have, like, a lot more support to, like, have a, you know, there would be other elements to making the plan that would have to come into play that wouldn't just be her staff coming up with a plan.
Right, exactly.
So it was a good plan for a staff plan.
Yes. So she, the one thing that was missing from at least that sort of paper about how she was going to pay for it was how she was going to roll it out.
Right.
So we got that this week. We know that Bernie's plan is sort of easy in the first year. The Medicare age goes from 65 to 55. The next year it goes down to 45. Then it's 35. And then everyone.
Yeah.
So it happens over, I think, that's
4 years.
Four years. Right, yeah. So she, I think, is trying to have it both ways and be real cute about it,
I think,
sort of.
Yeah.
And is going to do it faster than that, but she's going to have to pass two giant pieces of legislation to get it done.
It's sort of a delusional plan.
And the first piece of legislation is Medicare for all who want it.
Yeah.
So, like, that got jumped on immediately because basically what she said she was going to do was in the first 100 days was going to introduce legislation that was literally Pete Buttigieg's plan.
Yeah, it was a public option.
It was a public option. Which, like, okay, I mean, we have been saying that a public option, like, people wanted a public option in, you know, in Obamacare.
Right.
Like, that's pretty much what everyone other than Warren and Sanders' plan is some form of that.
Right.
It's what Biden's plan is.
It's
sort of Kamala Harris's plan, although
who knows what her plan is.
Like,
right.
And she has like a 15-year runway to get to Medicare for all or something because she really just doesn't know anything about healthcare, unfortunately for her,
exactly.
As she's proven time and again. But, you know, so she, as if to think, and then she, by the end of her third year, which, by the way, would be after midterms, then she's going to pass full Medicare for all. Because
we needed
previous
3 years
few years of the public option were going
to
have gone so great. And if that's the case, then that just proves Pete Buttigieg's point. Because his whole point is always that it's that public option that is just going to get us to Medicare for all. Because, like, everyone will want it.
And
that competition will push the insurance companies out of the way.
Right.
And we don't agree with that point.
Our point is that is, like, literally the worst way to get to Medicare for all because it will make the entire Medicare system seem unwieldy and too expensive.
Right. But a lot of people think that that idea is delusional, and I don't necessarily think those people are wrong.
No. I agree with you. I feel like I've had a lot of emotions about this week.
Yeah.
Because when you first sent it to me the day it was released, I just skimmed it and I was like, oh, she's going to get there in 3 years. Sanders' plan is 4 years. And I was like, she's trying
to... Well, and I think that was intentional.
And so my first reaction was like, oh, good for her.
Yeah.
And then when I was reading into what it involved, I was like, oh, we have to do 3 years of a dumb plan in order to get to the actual plan, which
is to pass two plans. As if the Republicans aren't going to run against a public option as if it's like some sort of communist takeover of our healthcare plan. Then she's going to somehow pass that. And then after midterms, which inevitably you lose.
You always lose.
In your first term. Like, that just happens.
That's life. Yeah.
Like, then she's going to pass, like, a full universal healthcare plan, like, before the first term is over, a second massive healthcare plan. It doesn't actually make logical sense.
No. And also, like, as I think we learned from the Obama administration, you get one shot in
you
your first 2 years.
Years. That's it.
And if you don't pass fucking healthcare reform, then you don't get to have healthcare reform.
You get one big legislative push. And
that's right.
Not only that, you have to pick and choose what those battles are anyway. Because as we know, Obama wanted to also do immigration reform, and he couldn't even get to that because he spent all the political capital on Obamacare.
Yeah.
So to think that you're going to pass a public option and then come back after the next year's midterms and pass universal healthcare is really cuckoo bananas.
It's cuckoo bananas. Well, and it also, It's funny because it also doesn't jibe with her rhetoric in the right way. Whereas, see, I feel like Sanders, because his rhetoric is, we're going to do this together, never makes his plan impossible because it's never about him. So he'll be like, yeah, of course this sounds nuts, but we're going to do it together. You are going to have to also elect other people to help me do this. You, like, we all have this responsibility now. I'm going to be the guy who's proposing this idea, but we're all going to have to do it.
Yeah.
And that's his, that's how his rhetoric operates. So he could propose almost anything that sounds ridiculous, which is what he does. And everyone's sort of like, well, his plan is that we're all going to do it together. So it's not just on him. He doesn't need the plan. The plan is that we're all going to do it.
Yeah.
Her rhetoric is a lot less, you know, and she still has the rhetoric of sort of we're in this together. Like that's
right.
But her rhetoric is a lot less movement focused. And so, and this is a plan that really requires a movement focus.
It really does.
Because we have to all be in it together to do this plan. We have to be in it for the long haul together. Right. Whereas, you know, I think Sanders often can say these things and doesn't have to come up with a plan like this because his plan is we have to, we all do it. And so there's other layers to this plan where other people are helping me do this because you're electing those other people too. And we're all sort of like spending all of our political capital on this together.
Yeah.
And so it's not about whether I do it best or whether I know best. It's about whether we all do. And like, this is such an oddly specific plan that would require so much political capital. And it, she doesn't sort of have the right rhetoric to support that type of thing.
And I think what is giving a lot of people, you know, cause for concern is, you know, that from, at least from the sort of like fringy left, there had been some questioning of her actual commitment to universal health care. Whether that was reasonable or not, now seems like it was reasonable. Well, because I think a lot of people on the left are now being like, look, she actually doesn't mean it. And I think that there are a lot of people, so you've pissed off the left, and now you also have, I don't know that you've necessarily pissed off the people
to
your
right. But you've validated their dumb idea.
You've validated their dumb idea. Right. So I think what a lot of people are going to be scared of is that you're going to use all of this political capital and you're going to get stuck with a public option. And for the reasons that we have said on this podcast, could very well be a poison pill to anything better happening again. I think it makes a lot of people nervous. And also, I think it makes rightfully nervous. And I think it also sort of is... Look, I think she's probably, to a degree, looking to a general election here.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people, at least on the left, which is a big part of her base, are worried about what else she's going to triangulate on.
Well, it's, this kind of made me... This was the first time that I have been like, has she hired new consultants?
Yeah, this seemed political. Besides the fact that it just doesn't seem like a great idea. Usually her plans are just sort of like, oh, well, that's just like a plan that like sounds like a plan that makes sense.
Right.
Like this, not only does it not actually make any sort of like logical sense as a thing that could happen, it also doesn't make good political sense.
No, because it's not a big idea. It makes a big idea smaller.
Yeah.
Like I feel like the thing that she was gaining capital with was the thing was that every time she released a plan, it was a big idea.
About big structural change.
Big structural change. This is not really offering big structural change. It's offering us a chance to go down a road we tried to go down once and failed at.
Right.
And it's offering us sort of like,
and it's offering the same thing that everybody else is offering.
The same thing that everyone else is offering. And
like, why bother?
I actually think that sort of, at least in the initial rollout of this campaign, that she was quite dedicated to Medicare for All.
Because I think she
as somebody who understands a lot about sort of the economics of families and consumers, she is someone who's uniquely positioned to understand how poorly the system works for people and
how
expensive it is.
She knows about bankruptcy. She knows how many people go bankrupt.
And so I think that she is someone who on a like basic level understands that the only way that you can get rid of that risk, you can try to mitigate the risk with a bunch of policies that are super complicated like Obamacare did.
Yeah.
Or you can get rid of that risk entirely by publicly funding a system.
Yeah.
I feel like because she started surging in the polls, they hired a bunch of consultants who are now in the same way that her calling card is simple explanations for complicated problems.
This has been overthought.
Yes. And the same in the last debate, it was the same problem where I know she couldn't say, I will lower your taxes or I won't lower your taxes or your taxes will go up or whatever. You know, she couldn't say your taxes will go up. That's what she couldn't say. But what she needed to say was, what they want me to say is that I am going to raise taxes.
Right.
here's what I'm actually going to do. Like, she she needed to say, with the clarity that she usually brings to a conversation like this, what they want me to say is this. That's the talking point they're trying to make me go down. This is an unfair question, though, because you, as a consumer, what do you care about? You care about costs. You don't care about taxes.
Yeah.
So whatever happens, I promise to lower your costs.
You'll have more money in your pocket at the end of the month.
Because of my plan. Do not let them distract you with this talk of taxes.
Yeah.
That is what she needed to say, and she did not do it, and she's normally so good at that.
Yeah.
That's what she's so good at explaining the need for taxes, first of all, because that she's the first person who I ever heard say, finally, well, don't we all fucking use roads?
I know.
Like, there are reasons we want public, there are reasons that a corporation should invest in the community, and it is because we are educating their workers, and we are providing the roads and the fire department and the police to protect them and get their goods to market and whatever. Like, she's normally so good at that kind of argument. Yeah. And on healthcare, everyone has overthought healthcare in this whole race except for Sanders.
Sure. I know.
Like, and it's because his plan is this. It's because he hasn't had to rethink it. It's been his plan since the beginning of time. Right. And he has the bill. He wrote the bill. The bill is his bill. So he doesn't really care.
Yeah, he wrote the damn
bill. Right. But the rest of them have, like, been tying themselves into knots to come up with inferior plans to the basic idea of just, like, universal
having
care.
Everyone have healthcare. Right.
Yeah. Right. None of these plans actually provide universal care except for a Medicare for All plan.
Yeah.
Every one of them leaves room for someone to not be insured. And that is the same for 3 years of a public option as it is for 100 years of it.
Yep.
You know, so I don't know why she needs to course correct on this issue.
I think so, too. It might be too, like, she can't say that this isn't what she meant, though. You know what I mean?
No,
like, I realize the one thing that I have sort of always liked about her is that besides being on the, you know, the left, certainly, is that she sort of like seems to have put together like a pretty decent broad coalition.
Yeah.
And we talked about that, I think, just in terms of sort of like who her supporters are. They don't necessarily agree with her on everything, but they just like her.
Yeah.
I think
and they think she's thoughtful.
I think that the people who are supporting her, because she is only one of the two candidates who support universal healthcare, I think are going to be rethinking that in the coming days.
Well, and she's already facing a situation where Sanders has been rising in the polls, which is a mystery that no one can solve. But, I mean, we can because we went to a Sanders rally this week. So who are we to say that? Yeah, this is awesome. So who are we to say that we don't understand that?
Yeah.
But a lot of it is that when she kind of triangulates or can't effectively communicate on an issue as important as healthcare, we are sort of left to think to ourselves, well, do we want to advocate for our positions, or are we about to make a vote that is about electability, or are we actually going to vote our position?
Right. Well, and that's
the
thing.
We shouldn't be having to make that choice between her and Sanders.
And this is the thing that you and I are, you know, have talked about being excited about, is that it's exciting that now that, like, if we don't agree with her rollout of this plan, there's another option for a rollout of the same plan.
We're loving having two progressives in the race, you guys.
If in 2016 we decided that we didn't like how Sanders was going to roll out his plan, then you were still stuck voting for Sanders.
Right, exactly. I think there were a lot of people who were kind of like, you know, I don't like Hillary, but like this is a bit much for me.
Right.
Whereas, you know, I think the nice thing about this is, you know, we have never had a discussion on the national stage about how we would actually move to a Medicare for All plan.
I know.
This is awesome.
Right. Yeah.
Like, and as much, you know, I'm disappointed with how her rollout happens.
Yeah.
I have literally never had the opportunity to think about what I would think about someone's
rollout. That's what I was just about to
this
say.
This is an important discussion. If we are actually going to have Medicare for All, we have to find out how we're going to fucking do it.
I was excited when I read that, being able to be a person who was able to process that as, like, maybe a not great idea.
I know.
You know what I mean? Like, I feel like 4 years ago I would have been like, sounds great.
Right. Anything works for me.
You know, like, what I mean?
No,
and, like, that we're sort of, like, able to, like, get into the nitty-gritty of, like, how this is going to get paid for and how – whether you're – like, whether or not your taxes are going to go up, even though that's a ridiculous question.
Right.
Like, that we're talking about it is, like –
as, like, a potential real thing.
Right.
And not just a talking point to in some vague future.
Right.
Like these are plans for, like, what
right,
we actually
do. From two candidates
do.
Who are doing well in the race.
Right, from two candidates who are in the front runner pool.
Right.
So that's very exciting.
Yeah.
That said, the Des Moines Register's latest poll was incredibly upsetting.
Yeah, Pete Buttigieg winning in a landslide.
You guys,
Don't do this.
I know we had this talk last week, so we don't need to have it again.
No.
But let me just refer you to our talk from last week, in which we remind you that he is not a credible candidate. He is the mayor of South Bend, Indiana.
Yeah.
That is not a place that you had ever heard of before Pete Buttigieg was running for president.
Right.
He is not someone who has ever worked in federal government. He is not even someone who's been in the state legislature. He is a random guy who is the sort of very politically talented upstart right. young mayor of a random city that you have never been to and never will go to
right.
in Indiana, which is not a heavily urbanized state.
And what's so confusing to me is he's also wildly uncharming.
I know.
people were sort of like being like he's the 2020 Obama.
No,
bitch, he's not.
He is not.
He's a snore for starters.
He doesn't have that like Beto charisma.
No.
That Beto had at the early, Beto doesn't have it anymore either, but he doesn't even have the Beto charisma, the sort of like kind of awkward white guy version of the Obama charisma.
Right. He comes off mean a lot of times.
Anytime that he is not telling you something super uplifting, he sounds like an asshole.
Right.
And I've noticed in particular women hear it.
Yeah.
So there's, I don't know what that's about, but I mean, I know that in that last debate, everyone I know who is female heard it. Suddenly.
Sure. Yeah.
And there were some men that heard it too, there were some that didn't.
And
but
honestly,
all
I think,
women heard it.
Honestly, I think a lot of gays hear it too.
I agree. No,
because,
I think so, definitely.
You know, I've been seeing like a lot of memes about him mm-hmm. where it's just sort of like, I feel like some fake Grindr profiles have been created for him where it says like, no fats, no femmes, no sort of, but
right.
like that, like.
No.
You can see that, like,
totally.
On his face, sort of, like, and it's just sort of, like, that idea of, like, him just sort of, like, being, I don't know what it is, but it's not.
Well, it's the same, he is also just, he hasn't earned our trust enough to use this tone with us,
yeah.
I think, some level. Like, I don't like it when any politician uses that tone with me,
yeah.
but I have been saying for weeks now, that if we're going to have a moderate in the race, let it be Amy fucking Klobuchar.
Sure.
Because she's a credible person.
Right.
I just disagree with her on everything. But I believe that she knows what she's talking about on some level because she is like a person who works, who is in the Senate, who like understands how federal government works. Even Obama had been working in federal government
right,
when he
for a couple years.
Ran for president.
Right.
And he had been in a legislature before that. So he understood how like sort of large government works.
Yeah.
City government, unless that city is New York City or something like that,
yeah.
You're not, that's not relevant experience to, first of all, life in South Bend, Indiana does not have much in common with life in a lot of cities in America. So
right.
It doesn't even have parallels to how 70% of Americans live.
Yeah.
It also doesn't have anything to do with how people in rural areas live.
Yeah.
It's being the mayor of a random mid-sized city
yeah.
does not give you that's not where a majority of Americans, it doesn't have relevance to a majority
sure.
of American cities, even the ones that are other mid-sized cities.
Yeah.
It's a very specific thing.
Yeah.
He's not a credible candidate.
No.
Also, black people are not going to vote for him,
correct.
As has been said all over Twitter all week.
Right.
And maybe even more so this week because he released a weird list of 400 supposed African-American endorsers of some plan that he had.
Yeah.
And first of all, only half of them were actually African-American.
Yeah.
And the other half were like, we didn't fucking endorse you. What are you talking about? They did an opt-out endorsement where they sent an email to everyone saying that if they didn't want to be on the list of endorsers, they could opt out.
Amazing.
So like South Carolina is a mess for him.
Oh, yeah.
So, he's going to sail maybe through Iowa and New Hampshire, two of
yeah.
the whitest states in the union. And then where
yeah.
are we going to be when we get to some real states?
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense.
Anyway, he's ahead 25. He has 25%. Warren has 16. And then Biden and Sanders are both at 15%. And then Klobuchar is at 6.
Yeah.
And
it's
then
just
it's just
turning
sort of
into a weird race
after that. Yeah.
Also, it's
yeah.
funny that Klobuchar is now the sort of the small time
oh, yeah,
person
no, right?
In the
it used
race.
To sort of either be Harris or it used
or
to
Booker.
Or what? Right.
I
or
mean,
it was Buttigieg.
Or it was
for a
Buttigieg
second,
for a long time. Yeah.
Yeah, because this is a 16 point swing for him.
Yeah.
Since
but
September.
Remember when we were in Iowa at the Colonel poll, he was like fucking killing it? Like,
yeah.
there is this weird Iowa obsession with him that I think
yeah.
was a trend that finally made it into the polls, but might still just be a trend.
Oh, I think it is. Well, and the one thing, there's some polls. First off, Biden. What a shit show for him, by the way.
What a mess.
He had led like the first tweet three times that they, and this was like an additional 5-point tank for him.
Yeah.
I mean, He's
leading in national polls, but by smaller and smaller margins.
Yeah. But those national polls continue, I think, to be name recognition. And I know we've been saying that for a long time, but like people are just starting to, I read an article actually that part of the reason, at least, you know, there's been a lot of things that have gone right for Sanders recently. You know, he got the endorsement of like most of the squad, and you know, he's gotten a couple endorsements and big this unions, week. Yeah. The UTLA, the United Teachers of Los Angeles, the LA Teachers Union. But also, they were making the point that a lot of people who sort of like have at least supported his 2016 campaign are probably just now coming to be paying attention.
Yeah.
Like, you know, young people, the types of people that he has sort of like added to his coalition, he's winning with Latinos now, are not necessarily people who have remained hyper engaged for the last 4 years since his last campaign. So I think that Biden is going to continue to slip.
Yeah, he only has one direction he can really go.
Right, but this is a 5-point slip in Iowa just since September. There is not really, especially when you look at all of the state polls, because I don't think he's ahead anywhere in the first four states anyway. And then you're to Super Tuesday, which is just going to be a shit show.
Yeah.
I don't think you can effectively call him the front runner any longer.
Oh, I don't.
But I don't know who you would necessarily.
No, it's
because,
chaos out there.
Because Warren isn't ahead in many national polls. I think there's some outliers that have her as such. Buttigieg is nowhere near leading in the national polls, but is leading in Iowa. Either Sanders or Warren is ahead in New Hampshire. Biden is still ahead in South Carolina with, you know, a huge portion of black voters down there. It's close in Nevada. It's chaos. And I think to a degree, that's probably why you're seeing some of these other guys think that they can get in late and win. But I want to go back to that really quickly because part of the reason, you know, we went to a Sanders rally yesterday, and I know that we have been sort of discussing whether we're Sanders and Warren people. And I still don't really know, but I feel like at this point in time, I'm more, even before this Warren healthcare plan came out, have been feeling Sanders. And I think it's important because we talked about Bloomberg last week. And Deval Patrick is another corporatist, by the way. Yeah. I mean, just
charter school guy.
Just recently resigned at Bain Capital, by the way. Right. Like literally this week.
Yeah.
Like had a profile up at, you know, he was on the board. Was on the board at AmeriQuest, which was like the leader in subprime mortgages that bankrupted like most of America. So, I mean, this is a guy who like does not, and he's also like, he was interviewed on Meet the Press this morning and was like, well, I'm coming in late enough that I'm probably going to have to take corporate money. And I think he's got a PAC supporting him and stuff.
Good.
So like, you know, I mean, and these people are not getting in the race because they're scared that Donald Trump might win in 2020.
No.
They are getting in the race because they are scared that either Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders is going to win in 2020. And if you spoke to them privately, they would obviously be more concerned about Bernie Sanders winning than they would with Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah.
They would be able to live with Elizabeth Warren and just sort of like deal with maybe 2 cents coming off of their billions of dollars. They are more scared about Bernie Sanders. And for that reason,
let him be fucking. Let's dive in.
Let's dive all the way in.
No,
because
I
fuck those guys.
Agree.
Because they are only worried about someone from the left winning this primary. They don't give a shit about Trump.
That's right. No, and that I think is I think the sort of reason A that you're seeing like him and Warren's polling evening out a little bit, Sanders and Warren's polling evening out a little bit, and the reason that you're seeing him rising in the polls in the first place, because that shocked even me. And it's so funny because I feel like I'm someone who's like a natural Sanders camp person from years back. So we were planning to support him in that primary before he was even a real candidate in the primary.
Yeah.
We were joke supporting him in the primary with joke. You had a novelty T-shirt about it,
right.
You know, back
decades ago,
like long before any of this came up. So I'm, you know, we're people that are in the natural constituency for a, you know, Sanders style run.
Right.
So it's not, I feel like I am almost finding myself having the conversation and being on the other side of it that I was having with other people about whether to vote for Sanders or Clinton, where I was saying to them, you know, I know, like, they were saying to me, no, but she's, like, electable, and he's not electable. And I was saying, you have to vote your principles in a primary,
right,
because otherwise, how do they know where the base is?
Yeah.
And now I'm sitting around being like, oh, maybe I have to vote my principals in the primary because otherwise how do they know where the base is? And right. like my principals would be like well-ish represented by Liz Warren, of course.
Sure. Yeah.
But are my principals maybe better represented by Bernie Sanders? And should we maybe make that clear to some of these people that we're trying to fucking terrify?
Yeah.
That that is actually yes. where the principles of the base
right.
lie? Because yeah. do I want to sort of give away the piece of my vote that is straight Medicare for all, you right. know, right, right away? Or like, do I want to give away those pieces of my vote? Do I want to give away 4% on top marginal tax rates? Because I think it sounds more reasonable. It's more likely that we sound reasonable when we elect someone who only wants 2% instead of right. 6% or whatever. Like, right. like maybe not. I don't,
yeah.
you know, I've never sort of been in this position where I've had to make this yes, choice. It's kind right. of exciting. And yeah. you know, like, as people will often be like, oh, you know, I'll vote for any Democrat because anyone would be great. I feel about Sanders and Warren like either of those would I would be excited about.
Right.
Of course. And I've been and I also have said for a long time that Warren is somebody who I think could speak to a broader coalition of yeah. people than Sanders. And because of that was someone I really wanted to see in the race. And I think she's doing that. So like,
yeah.
great. I'm not someone who feels that way about a lot of the people in the middle, you know, where I don't yeah. feel like, oh, I would vote for literally anyone to not vote for Donald Trump. I wouldn't vote for Donald Trump, obviously.
Right.
But I'm not trying to vote for literally anyone out there. I don't even want to conceive of my vote that way. Right. I would never conceive in a primary process. I would never conceive of my yeah. vote that way.
Yeah.
But it's like these people are entering the race. These billionaires are entering the race. And these rando moderates are entering the race because they're fucking terrified of Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
So let's scare them.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean.
Exactly.
Let's own that.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
We got a debate coming.
We have a debate coming
yeah.
this week.
This week, yeah.
10 people.
There will be 10.
We are not getting...
We keep promising you that there's going to be less people on the debate stage, damn it.
Like, why is Tom Steyer going to be there? Why is Tulsi Gabbard there? Like, there are so many questions about...
Yeah.
The only notable person who's not going to be there is Julian Castro.
Right. And this is the first debate that he's missed so far.
And
so
the only one of these nonsense people that I think probably would be helpful to have in the debate. Sure. Do I care if Cory Booker is at the debate? Like, not super.
No.
He hasn't been adding much to the debates. Like,
certainly... No, he just wants to be nice to everyone.
Right. I certainly don't care if Tom Steyer's there.
No. Yeah, Cory Booker just wants to go there and then pretend that they shouldn't debate while they're there.
No, exactly. He wants to high-five everyone there and then just, like, you know...
Yeah.
Play a game of football together.
but, yeah, we'll see. I mean... It's going to be interesting because of the reason that we just said about, like, who the... I'll be curious to see sort of, like, who goes after who here.
Yeah.
Because for so long, it was, like, everybody going against Biden. The last debate was everybody going against
Warren.
But
Buttigieg is ripe for going against.
Right? I mean, like, do people finally come after him? Is this the type... Is now the time where Klobuchar comes for him to try and make herself seem like the reasonable...
If she is smart, I feel like she should.
You know...
Because... She is the only moderate who is, like, even a credible human right. being.
And she's already spent the last 100 debates going after Warren anyway. So, like, that's just been a waste of her time so far anyway.
Exactly.
She needs to sort of, like, be she needs to be the moderate
yes.
in the
she's
race.
She's not competing with Warren for voters.
Right. She can't be the remaining moderate in the race unless she takes down Biden and Buttigieg along the way.
No.
So, like, I think it could actually be very fascinating because, I don't think that there is, like, there's no clear punching bag, I don't think, probably.
I'm also hoping, and I think that this is getting less likely, the more sort of, like, antagonistic some of the Warren Sanders camp are getting towards each other,
yeah.
that they stay a united front for a little bit longer into the process.
Yeah,
I think it is just smarter for them to do that.
It has been beneficial to them so far, I think.
Yes, and I think... That they will have a chance to make the distinctions between them clear.
Yeah.
But I think that they should wait until they have effectively knocked the moderate voice out of the discussion so that Warren sounds moderate. And that way we can find out where people
where
actually stand.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people will still stand on the far left. I don't think that's, you know, necessary. But I want them to stay a front until the point where it is safe for them to make that distinction without the left screeching itself to it. You know, the left will eat itself any old day. Like, we're idiots. We don't know how to be smart strategically. I think a smart strategy for us is always to be about the policy and not about the attacks.
Yeah.
And I think that Sanders and Warren are really good at that.
Yeah.
And if they come for each other this time... We're going to see sides of both of them that we don't really want to see, where it's going to become clear that Warren's plan is subpar. It's going to become clear that, you know, Sanders is grumpy. You know,
I have a feeling there's no way that this debate happens where Sanders doesn't point out that he disagrees with her on the rollout. That doesn't mean they have to sort of like get into an argument with each other.
No, I think that they should resist, because there will be an attempt to make them get into an argument.
I think they should reiterate that they both have the same goal.
Right, and explain the differences. Right. Let her try to make a defense of this idea.
Well, yeah, she's going to have to.
Explain the differences, for sure. But I don't think that they should take the tone with each other that they should take with the rest of the field. I think they should continue to be like, we're the only people fighting for this.
We want to cover everyone.
We disagree about how we're going to get there, maybe, but we're the only two people on this stage. And your argument, your choice to make right now while there's 10 people on this stage is, do you want this vision or do you want that vision?
Right.
And if you want this vision, there's only two people to consider.
Right.
And then let us fight it out.
Agreed.
You know, like that I think would be smart.
Yeah.
I don't know what will happen, though. Warren has all these new people just giving her advice that's stupid.
Yeah.
She really needs us in there.
Anyway, Katie Hill's seat is, we're going to have a special election at some point. We don't know when.
Heating up.
It's going to be crazy because we already told you that Papadopoulos thinks he's going to run for it.
George Papadopoulos, genius thinker George Papadopoulos.
Right, and now Cenk Uygur.
Now wants to
also
file
wants
documents.
To run, right?
And the Democrats have already basically coalesced around a candidate. So, that's already confusing. Because Christy Smith, who's a state assembly person from that area, had already declared she was going to run.
And Katie Hill endorsed her.
A lot of the people who are running for statewide office in that region have already endorsed her.
Yeah.
I believe that Kip Mueller, who was on our podcast a few weeks ago, I think his campaign endorsed her. They rolled out those endorsements real quick, and they were really on it. So they were looking for that opening to get there as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
But so it's going to be one of those fun jungle primaries where,
have a jungle primary, or is this because it's a?
Oh
I
yeah,
guess they would
no,
have
it's
have
jungle
to,
primary.
Right?
This is a jungle primary. They're all running together. This is going to be wild.
What a world!
It's just going to be, and like this sort of like the number of pseudo celebrities that are going to be running in this district because it's just outside the LA city limits.
So great,
just so that they can represent Simi Valley.
Simi Valley, I know. Can like Kim Kardashian run in this district or something too?
Probably.
Who can't? I know.
There's a lot of people I feel like who live in vaguely wealthy exurbs of LA who are like in this district.
Yeah.
Like I bet every celebrity has an address in this district.
Probably.
At least.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, this district also just had a school shooting.
Oof. Oh yeah.
It was at Katie Hill's alma mater.
Oh, I didn't realize
she went
that.
To that high school.
Oh my gosh.
Not related to this, but. As we were talking about school shootings, there was some interesting news on the Sandy Hook lawsuit.
Yeah, this is
lawsuit front.
This is exciting because the Supreme Court earlier this week said that so there are some survivors and relatives of victims of the Sandy Hook school shooting, they were attempting to sue the makers of the rifle.
Right,
it's a Remington rifle. And basically like hold them liable for the shooting.
Right.
So that had been going through it had gone to the Connecticut Supreme Court, and, you know, Remington had wanted to have the Supreme Court hear it, and the Supreme Court was like, pass.
Yeah.
So this lawsuit can go forward.
Yeah.
So we don't know what's going to happen with it.
This
We're going to keep
really
our...
the first time that families and victims have gotten the chance to sue a gun manufacturer for providing their product to the wrong crowd, to the
wrong
people.
It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out.
Yeah.
For sure.
Well, you know, and the reason this never happens is because there was a federal law that was shielding manufacturers from these kinds of lawsuits, which is crazy, by the way, you guys. If you're thinking that our gun control laws are fucked because we let crazy people have guns and they're more fucked than you think because there are laws shielding anyone from having any like obligation to do the right thing on any level, on the manufacturing level, on the ammunition level. There are all these laws that actually shield the manufacturers of these weapons and shield the sort of the chain of businesses that would sell you these weapons from any liability in any of these cases.
Yeah.
But you know what? If you're producing something that is too dangerous for regular people to have access to, and then you give it to those regular people, that should also be your fucking fault.
Yeah.
I think that, first of all, going after manufacturers is one of the ways to make it not a profitable business to sell kind of weaponry to regular people.
Yeah.
But I just want to remind everyone that we could also be pursuing the insurance option.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
We could do it on both ends. We can make it too expensive to manufacture and sell these, and then on the other end, we can make it too expensive to own them.
Yep.
And then we just let the market take care of it. And we love the market in this country. We love, right now we are using laws to protect a market that doesn't deserve to exist.
Yeah.
We shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah.
But so in any case, the lawsuit says that Remington Arms should never have sold a weapon as dangerous as the Bushmaster AR-15 style rifle to the public. Yeah. And that was what Adam Lanza used in that shooting. And it also alleges that Remington Arms has been targeting younger at-risk males in their marketing and product placement because they've been doing product placement in violent video games and things like that. So I'm interested to see whether they wind up having any liability for any of this, because they should.
Yeah, I think so too.
But this is really the first time we're going to get a chance to talk about it.
Yeah.
So that was the news this week.
It was. Follow us on all the social media, just in general.
Well, you should.
For the debate this week.
Yeah, we always will be on top social of that, media eyes for the debates. We often social media eyes for various parts of the hearings.
Yeah.
We're out there.
We just took a bunch of fun pictures at a rally the other day.
Yeah, I mean, we're giving you all the best
content
that you could ask for. We're not on TikTok, but that's because I don't know what TikTok is.
I'll tell you later.
Okay, great. So we'll see you next week.
Bye.